This is Sustainable East End, a show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. Internationally famed landscape designer Edwina van Gaal lives in the bucolic hamlet of Springs in East Hampton. Recently, Edwina took me on a tour of her property on the banks of Accabonic Harbor. She says the land there is her laboratory for finding how to manage a mixed woodland and native grassland environment, and how to control invasive species and ticks. Here's our conversation as we walked about the grounds.
So I bought this house about in 2003, and I actually two houses side by side, one right on the harbor and the other more upland. And the house on the harbor had been mowed, the area, but not as any kind of a really highly tended lawn. And the house upland, more upland in the trees, was not really managed at all. So it was surrounded by a lot of invasives. So the house on the water, I restored simply by stopping the mowing and allowing the existing grasses that were latent in the soil, the native grasses, to come back, which they have done very nicely. Through the years, the deer pressure has changed the wildflower component, but it's still beautiful because new things are moving in to take the place that the deer don't eat, to take the place of the ones the deer did eat. So there, it's always adjusting. My approach is wait and see, like relax, let go. And this is my big design philosophy. And the more I can convince people to just relax a minute, exhale, wait and see. But what I did do was, and also look around, because like I looked around here and you see that these are all cedars, but the first line up from the water is the wild cherries, then you see cedars, and then you see oaks. So I wanted to try to bring it back to that a bit. So a friend of mine had a field through a bay full of wild baby cherries. So I brought them in. Luckily, that was before deer. So they got established before the deer could eat them.
And say a little bit about the kinds of grasses, native grasses, that came back.
Largely panicum, which is switchgrass, and little bluestem, which is Schizacrium scoparium, and greasegrass, which is kids love because you pull your hand along it and it feels like lanolin. Mm-hmm. There's also Aragrostis, which has the best name of all, which is purple love grass. Mm-hmm. And they're all warm season grasses, which means they bloom at the end of the summer. So all summer long, they're green. And now in the fall, they are blooming. And they will hold their seeds and their beautiful fluffy pods or whatever they use to disperse their seeds well into the winter. So this provides great forage for insects and birds. And then in the spring, early spring, I will cut it down. I've started a new practice for the cutting, which is to use a weed whacker and cut it about 12 inches high. I learned this from an entomologist, which is that the cut ends of the grasses provide places for the solitary bees to lay their eggs. And the most of our bees are native solitary bees. They're over 400 in New York State. And people are, you've seen bee hotels and everything that people are making?
They're like the little reeds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the solitary bees need little openings in order. And we've removed most of this kind of habitat. So a meadow provides extremely important overwintering habitat for a lot of the insects that the birds will need when they return in the spring, or also our birds that stay through the winter. So it's really important to remember that trees and plants are born to be eaten. That's the role they play in the ecosystem. So when you see some nibbling on a leaf, that is not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That means the birds will have, especially if it's caterpillars, because that's really the only food that a baby bird can eat, because they're soft and they're filled with protein.
So where are we going now?
Now we're going to walk through the cherry grove, which I planted, and which provides amazing berries, which are just over now. The birds have been eating the berries all fall. And this is the native black cherry. And we're going to walk to the second property, which was the one that was completely covered with, let's go this way up the bark chip path. This was totally covered with Rosa multiflora and bittersweet, primarily the primary invasives in here. And so the first thing I had to do in this area was to get all that out of the trees, which I reached as high as I could, you know, to cut them down. And then I had to leave everything that was in the trees. And it took about 5 years before all those vines just disintegrated and fell to earth. But as I was clearing the ground plane, I realized that I saw the rabbits and little things running away. And I realized I'm removing all their habitat. So I rolled up all of these masses of vines and just laid them around the edges so the thrushes and things could still have a place to hide until they reestablished, until I could reestablish. But also beneath all of that, there were a lot of dead trees. So I'd been working on this idea because this is my experimental place. So I come here to fail, really, to try things that fail. Because failures inform me of what the limits are of an idea. And then in my landscape design practice, I can really advise people intelligently in what will work and what won't work, or at least what will and didn't work for me right here. Sometimes we push the limit and you never know. But it's really about relaxing and watching and allowing nature to play a role. And so, for instance, we're looking at a dead pine tree. People know that the pines, some of the pines are in decline. I don't think this was the beetle because this tree died a number of years ago. But it's not near my house and it's not near anything. And I leave them standing, dead trees. They're called snags. And they are also, I call them the living dead, because they provide an unbelievable amount of habitat for owls and squirrels, and they're just filled with bugs. So I've got some really interesting woodpeckers and other birds that really thrive on these trees. And dead trees don't just fall over intact. They disintegrate from the finest edgy tips, you know, little by little. They disintegrate back. So it's very seldom that a large piece will fall. It's just little bits and pieces. It just whittles away. Nature just, so little bits and pieces will fall off this tree. And there's one over there that did finally come down, but you know, I just rearranged it and now it's melting into the ground.
And so, I mean, I've got loads and loads of dead trees on my property. And I think in the wintertime, oh, that looks so bad. But you think I should keep them there?
I do. Actually, they're less noticeable in the winter, unless I guess they stand out because the trees that around them don't have leaves.
All the blueberry bushes don't have leaves anymore.
Oh, well, blueberry bushes are not going to provide. Oh, so they're hiding the dead trees.
Right. Not blueberry. What are they called? The native little.
They look like huckleberry.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think people should leave more dead trees because they're such an important habitat. And because once you start to look at them through the lens of the interest that they provide and the food and the cycle that they become part of, it's all about perception.
And actually, you know, I used to have this wonderful barred owl. And 2 years ago, I cut down a bunch of dead trees around a clearing where I know I'd seen the barred owl, and I have not heard the barred owl since.
Well, there you have it. Yeah. So, but stop cutting dead trees and see what happens. Maybe the barred owl will come back. Yeah. So one of my experiments here is that no biomass leaves the property. Biomass is everything that grows on your property. And I'm looking at what happens if you close the loop. So there's zero resource extraction. So that's sometimes a challenge, often. So if, for instance, when I came here and there were so many trees that as I uncovered them, I liberated them from the invasives, they were dead. And so I didn't know what to do because I wanted to replace them with trees. So some I kept standing, but others had already fallen down, or many of them were actually invasive trees themselves, like Norway maples. I had a lot of Norway maples and a lot of sycamore maples, neither of which are native to here, and they seed around prodigiously. So I cut them up and made log walls, which you see. And so
right.
While I was still working on organizing the property, I used the log walls to kind of give me ideas for how the property could be organized and separated into areas. Or I used them to screen my air conditioning unit. I used them to screen things that, like, also to for my neighbor, so she's not looking at, like, the ladders on the back of my shed. And it doesn't look like you intentionally said, hey, over here, I'm hiding something, you know, which is always a problem, I think, with the way people tend to screen things. They actually draw attention to the thing they're trying to screen by putting in an ornamental something. So what you're walking on right now is a chip made of bark, a path made of bark chips, which is part of this program, because whenever we take something down or change something, because I am still removing invasive trees like all the catalpas, but I didn't want to take them all out at once because I would have been left with not much. So we chip them and use them for paths. Bark chips are pretty good for tick control. And one day, right here on this path, two falls ago, I found a stinkhorn mushroom, which is an amazing looking thing. It's like, I couldn't believe it. It's extraterrestrial. But anyway, so now we're going to pass through.
These look like chestnuts, but they couldn't be.
They're hickory nuts.
Hickory.
Yeah. Oh. And so this is a big, what they call mast year. Mast is all the things that trees produce in the forest that are important for supporting life. And years when the trees are stressed, they produce more because they're working. They figure, oh, my life might be endangered. I'd better have a lot of babies. And typically then a mast year produces more rodents or things that feed on them, feed on the nuts and cones and things. So it's an interesting cycle to watch.
And I see you're protecting a baby maple?
That's an oak.
Oak.
Yeah, so all of the trees that I find, mostly the deer are eating what they call recruitment. Recruitment is the next generation of trees in a forest. And the deer are eating them all. So whenever I find a baby tree, I do my best to either put it someplace where it has a potential future, or I pot it up and I get it away from the deer, and then I put a cage around it or something until it's above the browse. And so because we just don't have many native oaks coming back, nobody grows native oaks. They don't transplant very well. Very few. There's not really available in nurseries, so I want to try to keep them in. With all the acorns, we should have plenty. And so this area is finally been mowed enough. I mow it just once a year, but that I don't really have much of the invasive stuff coming up in here anymore. So I'm going to start transitioning it to forest understory, but it's a challenge with the deer pressure. So I have to look, I'm looking at that, like what it can be. Over there, what it can be is moss, because it's so dark. And so there was moss already there. And so all I did was we're taking the grass out. What I do is I supplement that area, because what moss likes is lack of competition and high humidity, which is exactly the kind of reverse of the way you would try to grow a lawn or most plants.
Right.
So most plants you want to water seldom and deep, and moss you want to water frequently for very short periods. So you want the ground to be dry and poor, because if you water well, you'll get weeds, and that's going to kill your moss. So you water poorly and just keep spritz it, spritz, spritz. So I have mist heads in there that go on like 3 times a day. For a minute, just psh, psh, psh. And
wow, that's so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, It's and so that's the thing that you learn, not only from observing closely, but also talking to other gardeners. So I learned that from somebody who had a running a botanical garden who had a lot of moss. And so I asked him, how could it be that people say moss is prevalent in lawns that are highly acidic, but you also see it growing on concrete, which is full of lime, which mm-hmm. would be very basic. Mm-hmm. So how can that be? Mm-hmm. And he said, it's about unfriendly environments. Nothing else will grow there. Mm. So moss will colonize a place that where nothing else will grow.
That's highly acidic, highly basic. So you just put in little things in and have them on a couple of times a day.
Yep. So just keeping the humidity up. That's the whole key.
This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We continue with my talk with landscape designer Edwina Van Gaal as she took me on a tour of her land in Springs, East Hampton.
So here we're trying to get some more native ferns to grow. Mm. The deer are eating them, which is really frustrating because this is the native hay-scented fern. I'm experimenting with something that was told to me by someone knowledgeable. Those are the ferns, which is that when ferns are grown in a nursery, they're generally given a lot of fertilizer that to grow quickly and produce a saleable plant. That changes the sugars. And also, they don't have the soil biome of their native area. So two things are working against them. They'll be high in sugar and low in their native defenses, mm-hmm. because the soil biome creates natural defenses for plants. Mm-hmm. And so I'm spraying them with deer spray until they take up enough. They kind of work the fertilizer out of their bodies and they take up their natural biome and develop their defenses.
And that would actually defend against deer?
Fingers crossed. One of my experiments.
And what is this? Also have another.
Oh, this is just some ageratum, which is not native, but it threads its way all through the grass here, and the deer don't eat it. I'm not that rigid a person about stuff that has to be native. Mm-hmm. I like things that plays well with others. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so if it's behaving and the deer aren't eating it, and it can actually coexist and fill in bare spots, I'll take it. So yeah, and that's all about watching carefully. And I mean, there are things, you know, like miscanthus, which was behaving very well for many years, the big plumy grass, mm-hmm. and now it's just taking over our meadows and things. So things change. I don't know what they do, revert, whatever, something happens. That so you do have to keep your eye on things if you're playing with things, but that's the fun of it, because we're all, it's like a garden should never be thought of in my mind as done. It's never done. It's like, do you consider your family like done ever? Do you just say, okay, you're done, don't talk to me anymore?
Sometimes I felt like that.
Yeah, we'd like to, but you know, it's never that, because like our thing here at Perfect Earth is what we ask people to do is to create a relationship with a piece of land you love. Even if you don't own it, you can do this. Mm-hmm. And basically you're making a vow, I will do this place no harm. Mm-hmm. But it's also like, so that means I will not put chemicals on you. I will pay close attention to what your needs are. And we equate it to, okay, we've been living together, but now we're getting married, and I will not cheat. I can't cheat. Mm-hmm. No cheating. It totally changes the relationship.
Right.
So when you're challenged, you know, you're tempted to cheat. Like, oh, well, we could just put some Roundup on that invasive over there and be done with it. And you say, I'm not in a rush. Mm-hmm. We're going to figure this out.
Right.
This is part of the cycle.
So give us an example of a challenge like that where you might have liked to have used Roundup, but you, of course, wouldn't.
An example? Mm-hmm. Well, here would be, it's mostly for invasives. Like, mm-hmm. That's the big challenge right now. Two things, mm-hmm. invasives and ticks. Mm, okay. Those are the two big challenges for me in terms of talking to people and even on my own property. I have a grandson. Mm-hmm. I don't want him to get Lyme disease, mm-hmm. you know, but I also don't want to expose him to pesticides. And so it's like this moral dilemma, you know, that how much is too much? Well, maybe just a little, but since I've made this vow, I have to find a way. And if we all do this, you know what? That's putting a pressure on the people who have the resources and the knowledge to find a better way. Mm. So like up at the Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies, that's now the Center for Tick Research, they're working with finding a fungus that is specific to ticks, that it kills them. Now, it's going to take a few years to get it on the market, but this is the kind of pressure that we need to exert. If everybody says, we'll just spray, then where's the incentive to find a better way?
Exactly. Now, I have just a practical question. You have we're in a shady area where you're establishing a moss garden, but it's surrounded by a grass understory. How does this grass survive in all the shade?
Well, it just, like, it's self-selecting, you know, because this was just area that was completely overgrown with natives. So the first thing I did was just... invasives. So I just got rid of it. Now, I did do something that I would not do again, which was I seeded it with red fescue. Okay. Now, what I know now is that red fescues are extremely aggressive and not a good nurse grass for a eventual other planting. And so they will outcompete stuff. So it's taking a very long time for these areas to evolve naturally. Mm. So, but it's too big a space for me to just say, okay, I'm gonna rip all this out and plant it with something, mm-hmm. because it is shady and there is so much deer pressure, mm-hmm. that I don't know long-term, mm-hmm. what is going to be the best plant. So that's why I'm starting over there. I've got those hay-scented ferns, and mixed in with them is American Pachysandra, mm-hmm. not a plant most people know much about. Mm. The reason is it is not evergreen. So, in other words, it's zip in the winter. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful plant, mm-hmm. and it's really healthy, and the deer don't eat it.
Oh, which one is that?
I'll show it to you. Mm-hmm. Over here. Right there. We just planted it a couple months ago, so... But you can see it's doing very nicely in these poor and shady soils.
Wow. So yeah. Is this a plant that you buy or it just happens?
Yes. No, you got to buy it. It's not 100% native to here. It's mm-hmm. it's Pachysandra alleganiensis, so that tells you that it's like from the mid-Atlantic states.
Now, I see a lot of lamb's ears here, yeah. and these aren't... It's a very lush herb garden, it seems to be.
Kind of wild, though.
and the deer don't like
it. This is all stuff the deer don't eat, although some of them, these are all kind of what you'd call Mediterranean plants primarily, because the soils are so sandy that but it's less, not so shady here. But the deer often will eat the flowers off. So that's a challenge. So little by little, the things that they hit too hard, I move them into the fenced area, mm-hmm. and then try something else out here. But this is also intended to provide flowers for bees. Mm. And just
so what kind of flowers for bees?
Well, most of these herbs do well for bees. So this is like I have chamomile. Oh, the one that's native that's really great is pycnanthemum, which is mountain mint. And that, the deer do not touch because it is a mint. Mm. And it's really, I wouldn't call it aggressive, call it robust, you know.
Robust.
It's enthusiastic. And there are three different kinds, although there's one that is most often sold. I think it's called Muticum, Pycnanthemum Muticum. But see, here's one, there's another one there. Mm. And it's finished blooming now, but when this was in bloom, which was for quite a long time, the bees were all over it. Plus those garlic chives they love. Mm. And some years the deer will eat the flowers and some years they don't. Mm-hmm. Who knows what? You know, and then I have like chamomile, nepetas, tucrium, santalina. This santalina's proven to be a really nice plant for this herbaceous kind of herb garden that the bees like and the deer don't eat. So this area is was completely so thick with vines and invasives that you couldn't even walk in here. So little by little, I chopped my way through it and then replaced the trees that were invasive trees with native trees. And then it came to a point where I had like 50 trees in cages. And I decided, how about one big cage instead of 50 small ones? Because I had to keep enlarging them as the trees were growing. And I thought, and also I can start looking at what's going to come out of the ground. So I fenced this entire area. And it's only been about a year. And then the deer got in a couple of times. So, you know, these are challenges. But little by little, it's really interesting. And you'll have to check back with me mm-hmm. in a year or two to see how it does. But things that have been doing well, I just love native trees. So we have an American beech that's doing really well. We have hornbeams. And mm-hmm. I've been also looking at plants that American holly. Isn't that a nice one? Mm-hmm. And it's for some reason, it has yellow berries. It must have been that I got a selection of some sort. You never know altogether when you buy stuff. Mm-hmm. But hey, it's doing really well. I have a few of them through here. And I have a lot of oaks. And that is a sassafras because I'm crazy about sassafras. And I've got some shads too because they say that I'll get cedar wax wings if I don't know. We shall see. So, and I've got some sumacs, and I'm just trying all kinds of things here. As the trees grow, the shade will increase, so the understory will change, but I'm trying to keep some areas that will remain sunny. And I've planted a lot of asters in here and yarrows. You can't see them now because it's kind of, they're small, and we're trying to beat back the competition. Mm-hmm. But little by little, I'd like to think by next year it'll be a noticeable difference. And it's also helping, it screens out the road and without building a wall to the public. And I'm using my log walls to help keep the deer out. So by doing a fence plus a log wall, they won't jump into that. You can do a fairly low fence and you build a log wall inside that. And a lot of people are taking logs to the dump. And so you could just intercept that supply line and bring them to your property. 20% of our national landfill is landscape waste, which is such a waste because it's really useful stuff.
Edwina Van Gaal, this has just been such a privilege to walk with you on your beautiful property where your experimental, your laboratory, which is probably one of the most beautiful laboratories one could ever be in.
It's a nice place to live and play, yes. I've really enjoyed, it'll never end, you know, that's what I mean. A garden is never finished because this experiment and this relationship will never end.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. We talked with landscape designer and activist Edwina Van Gaal of Perfect Earth. Her Perfect Earth project is designed to raise consciousness about the dangers of synthetic lawn and garden chemicals. Find out more at perfectearthproject.org. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of every month. The programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rihanna.